From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside.
Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, finding solutions for the erosion at Ocean Beach.
It's not feasible right now to pick up and move San Francisco inland, right? It's just not going to happen.
Then a local filmmaker brings us an Iraqi women's basketball team and the challenges they face.
A lot of people think it's sort of an oxymoron when I was like, yeah, I'm making a feel-good movie about Iraq.
And we meet a local jazz legend.
I guess one of the most important things I think I've learned was how to play a ballad. I've learned a little more about how to sit across the table and have idle dinner conversation.
That and more today on Cross Currents. One thing more powerful than human will is Mother Nature. At San Francisco's Ocean Beach, the two forces have done battle for years over wave erosion. But only the city has something to lose. With the safety of its wastewater treatment plant at stake on the one hand and a lawsuit on the other, San Francisco's planners are attempting to find a solution that will placate Mother Nature and avoid the most expensive fix, retreat. Jamie Katsoufis reports.
When Bill McLaughlin looks at Ocean Beach, he sees a war zone, especially here at the end of Slope Boulevard, where white-capped waves have eaten away large chunks of the parking lot.
This is one of the things we like, you know, everybody likes to do is, you know, sit in their car and watch the ocean. The parking lot used to be way out there. It used to be like, there used to be like another row of parking slots.
McLaughlin is Erosion Committee Project Manager for the San Francisco chapter of the Surfrider Foundation, a coastal advocacy group. Over the past 20 years, he's seen more than half of the Slope Boulevard parking lot disappear into the ocean. Looking out across the hood of his car, McLaughlin sees a temporary barrier draped with caution tape that flutters in the wind, and then a 20-foot drop. The beach below is scattered with bits of asphalt and concrete rubble. To the left, a wall of boulders stretches south and out of sight.
Our organization, we got involved in like 98, 97, 98, right after they put the first batch of boulders in right here in the north lot. We were like all like, whoa, what are you doing? What's going on?
That rock wall has become kind of a battle line. The city on one side, the Pacific on the other. It was built to stop the erosion before it uncovers buried sewer tunnels. They run underneath the Great Highway. If that happens, the tunnels could break and leak sewage all over the beach. Environmentalists don't like the rock wall because it actually speeds up erosion. Every winter, Pacific waves come racing in to crash on shore. When they hit the rocks, the wave energy is amplified, scouring the sand and causing the rock wall to sink, which means you need more rocks. The cycle continues until all the sand has disappeared and waves are left lapping against a jagged pile of boulders. No more dune habitat, no more recreation area, no more Big Surf. That's a future nobody wants for Ocean Beach, but the city has made little progress on the issue. Mark Massara, a surfer and longtime resident of Ocean Beach, is fed up.
They continue to dump this hazardous debris at the beach, and our frustration is at the boiling point.
Massara is also an attorney with the California Coastal Protection Network, an environmental group suing the city over the rock wall. He says that the wall was built as a temporary fix, but has cluttered the beach for more than a decade.
I'm convinced after working with the city for 20 years that it's going to take courts intervening and order the agencies to clean up this mess is the only way it's going to be dealt with.
If his lawsuit succeeds and those rocks remain on the beach, the city could be fined up to $15,000 for each day the rubble remains. So the city has some financial calculations to make. Lawsuits are expensive, but those rocks are protecting an even more expensive investment, a $200 million sewage treatment plant that's currently located in an erosion danger zone. Marla Jarosek is a regulatory compliance manager for San Francisco's Public Utilities Commission.
Ratepayer dollars can only go so far in looking at the sewer infrastructure, and we have to prioritize that in a way that, you know, our governing agencies and bodies, you know, support.
Environmental groups aren't the only concerned citizens. Recently, the State Coastal Commission denied a city request to construct more and more permanent seawalls. Charles Lester, executive director of the Coastal Commission, explains.
We're in favor of solutions that take, for lack of a better term, the softest approach possible and provide the most opportunity for natural physical processes to run.
Lester says the Coastal Commission does understand the city's economic realities.
Feasibility is sometimes a question of economics. Sometimes it's just not feasible to, I mean, it's not feasible right now to pick up and move San Francisco inland, right? It's just not going to happen.
Which is why the city is starting to look for alternatives. Peter Mull, who works for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, may have the answer.
Construct a dune.
From an environmental standpoint, dunes are good because they're built to erode. In the winter, the big waves grab the sand and suck it offshore to form large sandbars. And then in the summer, little waves bring the sand back to the shore. Across the seasons, the beach may grow or shrink as much as 30 feet. So the dune puts the sand back into the system.
And if that sand is placed over the rock that's there, I think a lot of the concerns of the citizens like Mark Massars would be ameliorated for a time because the rocks would be in a buried state, and it would buy time for the PUC, you know, to realize the life expectancy of this enormous investment that was made out there.
Every year, the Army Corps of Engineers dredges sand that collects in the bay.
The beauty of the solution that the Corps can bring to the table is we have to maintain the shipping channel anyway.
The federal government already pays to collect the sand and transport it over to Ocean Beach. So it would cost the city around $2 million to rebuild the dune every few years, which is a small price compared to the cost of relocating the sewage treatment plant. For the past few months, Mull has been working with SPUR, San Francisco Planning and Urban Research. They're a nonprofit that recommends solutions to city problems. Mull says SPUR will likely recommend building a 4,000-foot sand dune that would stretch south from Slope Boulevard down to the Fort Funston Bluffs as a crucial piece in their long-term erosion control strategy. The SPUR Ocean Beach Master Plan is expected to be released sometime in April. Beaches are great playgrounds and beautiful backdrops, but as Bill McLaughlin reminds us, they're also very much alive.
Many people build homes, roads, right up onto the beach. We all want that view, but the problem is that we forget, or maybe we're just starting to come to the realization that beaches move around. They come and go, they expand and contract, and you gotta give the beach the amount of space that it needs in order to do that, or you get these types of problems.
Mull's solution is at least a year away, which means more waiting. But whatever course of action the city chooses, it will likely be a lesson for beach communities across the country. At Ocean Beach in San Francisco, I'm Jamie Katsoufis for Cross Currents.
Initial hearings for Mark Massara's lawsuit against the city are set for mid-April. Right around the same time, SPUR will release its Ocean Beach Master Plan. We'd like to hear what you think about the Ocean Beach dilemma. How would you solve it? Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We turn now to the world of sports. Last night, the Stanford Cardinal women's basketball team swept away the Duke Blue Devils 81-69 to make it into the Final Four. They were led by Nneka Ogwumike, who's projected to be the top pick in the upcoming WNBA draft. After the game, she shared her excitement with an ESPN reporter.
I mean, it's amazing. I'm so thankful that... Sorry, I'm so thankful here.
We know you're a rap.
Yes, but I'm so thankful for my team. I'm so happy we got the young kids to be able to get this experience. And I'm really happy right now that we can go to Denver and try to win two more games.
In the U.S., women's basketball got its start back in 1892 when the women of Smith College started their team, playing in floor-length dresses and corsets. Playing in a conservative society can be rough on women. And that brings us to our next story, which takes us on a trip, a long trip to northern Iraq. In the town of Sulaymaniyah stands the American University of Iraq, where a women's basketball program was developed as recently as last year. The team is made up of students from varying tribal and religious backgrounds, Sunni Muslim, Shia Muslim, Christians, and Kurds, groups that have not always gotten along in Iraq. Most of them had never run or played with a ball before they walked through the doors of this school. San Francisco film director David Fine captures the diverse team in his new film, Salam Dunk. In this clip, team manager Safa, who's from Baghdad in southern Iraq, talks about being in close contact with northern Kurds for the first time.
For me, as an Arab person, when I was in Baghdad, I had something against Kurdish people, and also Kurdish people has something against me. But once I'm the manager of the basketball team, I have to deal with Arab, Kurd, Turkoman, Christian. I have to deal with all of them.
That was Safa, the AUIS team manager, talking about moving from Baghdad to Sulaymaniyah and the change of attitude towards Kurds that happened in her. What did the girls learn from each other and about each other that brought them closer despite their cultural differences?
Yeah, well, let's look at it through the lens of specific girls on the team. So Leylan, who's sort of the de facto star of the film, she's half Arab and half Kurdish. So she grew up in Baghdad in an environment where, you know, her parents sort of encapsulated the two sort of main ethnicities of Iraq. Now, obviously, there's Turkoman and there's, Iraq is such a diverse place, religiously and ethnically. Safa, Arab from Baghdad, admits very readily in the film that she had a difficult time treating Kurds as she also would treat her Arab student counterparts. And what's interesting is that her realization that she needs to change and turn that around was really born out of her need and her just intense desire to turn Iraq around. She wants to be, and many of the students at that university want to be, the leadership class of that country. And what they're realizing is that it's not going to work to just go in your corner and, you know, get with your own team. That hasn't been working. That all, you know, there's been so much fighting and no resolution for so long that this young generation of Iraqis is realizing the power of acceptance. And I think that basketball is just a catalyst for that. I mean, when you're on a team together and you're working towards a common goal, that stuff just melts away. It was like a lot of the girls said it was a non-issue on day one. You know, it was like immediately gone. And there are, you know, 3-4 sects of Christians on the team. There are Sunnis, Shias. You know, ethnically, there's Turkmans, there's Arabs, there's Kurds. It's across the board.
Did the girls talk politics at all? Did
they
talk to you?
They hate talking politics.
They hate it.
Yeah, they really do. That, you know, the closest I got, and a quote that I thought was really, really interesting was from Leylan, who I asked, you know, so was it celebrated when Saddam was removed? And she said, Saddam did, you know, a lot of bad things, clearly, but now we have 10 Saddams. And I thought that was really powerful. You know, they're so incredibly self-aware about how the world perceives Iraq. And honestly, I think that's why they were willing to let me make the film. You know, our goal was to show people a different side of this country and to not make a film that's like all the other films that come out of Iraq that's about war and despair and, you know, politics and, you know, foreign policy. And when I explained that to them, that was kind of my mission, they were right on board because they're tired of their country being portrayed that way too. You know, there's more to it.
Right. And they want to be the people who change it.
Yeah.
They see themselves as that. In this clip, we're going to hear two students, Ola and Leylan, who are from
Baghdad originally. We're going to hear them talk about the dilemma they face going to an American university, and when they go back home to Baghdad, not being able to be honest about what kind of university they go to.
For all my family, they are sure that this university is the best university in Iraq. But sometimes we are a little afraid about talk about that, especially in Baghdad.
When I went to my high school, I couldn't say that I'm from AUIS University. It's not because of rich person, it's because you are joining American University.
When if anyone asked me here, you are in which college or which university, I will say, I am in AUIS. I'm proud. But in Baghdad, I will never say that. Yeah, I can't. I'm afraid.
You're listening to Cross Currents on KALW Public Radio. I'm Hanat Baba, and I am speaking with David Fine, the director of the film Salam Dunk. So we just heard Leylan and Ola talk about being from Baghdad and, you know, saying basically, when I go back home, I can't say I'm going to an American university. So to what extent is that really an issue and a problem? You know, they're going to this American university. Their coach is very American in light of the American presence in Iraq. What kind of problems might they fall into if they kind of say, I go to the American University at Soleimani?
In Baghdad, there's, from what the girls told me, there's a huge amount of, you know, anti-American sentiment. And so to admit readily that you go to a school called the American University, regardless of how American that is or sort of the degree to which the Iraqi people perceive it as colonialist in nature, it's not something you want to take the chance on. And that's the impression that the girls gave me. Iraq is really, there's really two different Iraqs. In South Iraq, it's, you can't openly admit in Southern Iraq that you are an American or that you have American affiliations.
Right. And a couple of them were saying, you know, us playing in a basketball team like this, you know, would never happen. Leylan, I think, says that you'd never see this in Baghdad. You'd never seen this in Baghdad.
Yeah.
So she was kind of escaping that as well. And she sees herself as freer in Kurdistan.
The other side of that coin, the other sort of half of the country, is this semi-autonomous Kurdish region where, as an American, I had a hard time paying for things. Americans are sort of regarded as...
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is...
People would pay for you?
We're revered in a way, you know, through a series of, you know, accidents and sort of political, you know, showmanship. Bush Senior and Bush Junior made some moves that made the Kurdish region exist, that gave it that sort of the no-fly zone and created that semi-autonomous region. And then later with the removal of Saddam under Junior, you know, all of a sudden we were the heroes because Saddam had brutally oppressed the Kurds for so long. And all of a sudden we were the people who were, you know,
freed them.
And so it's so different.
One of the realities, though, for many of the girls on the team, you know, we go through the movie and we see this amazing bond between them. And a lot of the film is really feel good in terms of them coming together despite their, you know, cultural differences and religious differences. And the first game they win and you're so happy. And then, you know, you get to know them kind of one by one and understand some of the concerns they have. And one aspect of life in Iraq is the bombings. And at one point, there's news of a bus being bombed. The next day, the team doesn't play so well. So here's Leylan talking about that.
The bus was blown up, and we know most of the people on that bus. And I cried a little bit, and we didn't talk about it, really. Next day was a new day. Nothing happened yesterday. That's it. I just decided not to cry.
So the girls are you know, frustrated at this point at losing. Or are they frustrated at the bombings or both?
Yeah, they care a ton about winning. It's, you know, that they want to win for themselves and they want to win for their coach. And it almost felt as though the passion that they put into the game is so that they can divert attention from some of the other things that are going on.
So, you know, throughout the film, we get to know these young ladies. It kind of, we get to know more about some than others, and we meet families, and we go home with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see them lose, and we see them win, and we see them laugh, and we see them cry. What do you want the audience to take away from watching Slam Dunk?
Really, I want the film to be a counterweight to everything else that we're seeing, and to give some hope. You know, it's, a lot of people think it's sort of an oxymoron when I was like, yeah, I'm making a feel-good movie about Iraq. But that's exactly what it is and what it's intended to be. And I just hope that people start to rethink their perceptions about the country.
That's David Fine, director of the film Slam Dunk. You can attend a free screening of the film this Thursday evening in Piedmont. All the details are at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The great jazz man Milt Jackson had an easy way of telling people what instrument he played. He pointed to his lapel, where he wore a gold pin in the shape of his instrument. It saved him from explaining what the instrument was. Most would call it a xylophone, but with electronic accessories, it can produce a vibrato. That instrument's called a vibraphone. For nearly 50 years now, a jazz artist who lives right here in Northern California has enjoyed a career as one of the great performers on the vibraphone, commonly called the Vibes. At 71 and diminished by respiratory illness, he's still playing the Vibes and indisputably will always be a force in creative jazz. In 2010, he was awarded the highest honor in his field, the Jazz Master Fellowship Award of the National Endowment of the Arts. Reporter David Ross profiles the career and the music of the great Bobby Hutcherson.
The audience greets the band with applause. The rhythm section vamps while the leader stands motionless at center stage. He smiles, and then the mallets in his hands strike the bars of his vibraphone, soon producing a musical flurry. Barely out of his teens, Bobby Hutcherson found fame first playing and recording in New York City in the 1960s. He's since toured the nation and the world from his home base in the seaside town of Montara on the San Mateo coast. The Vibes have been his life since his days as a youth in the small and proud African-American community of Pasadena, California, that produced baseball and civil rights legend Jackie Robinson. Music was in the family, and Bobby started on piano with lessons from his aunt. His sister and brother were musical, too, and their friends included the great saxophonists Los Angelinos Dexter Gordon and Eric Dolphy.
And I had an older brother who was 15 years older than me, who went to school with Dexter. After they'd go to school, they'd come home and watch over me. I had an older sister who was a singer. My sister went on to sing with Ray Charles. You know, she made that recording, Let's Go Get Stoned. She was one of the Raylettes.
When Bobby switched from piano to Vibes, he blossomed as a musician very quickly. And before he was out of his teens, he was invited to New York to work with another friend of the family, saxophonist Billy Mitchell, who had made his name with the Count Basie Orchestra. Soon Bobby's playing in his original song, Little Bee's Poem, were getting him a lot of notice. He was part of a very special group of young modern jazz artists recording for the Blue Note label and extending the boundaries of their idiom. They included Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, and Freddie Hubbard. The 60s were an exciting time for jazz in New York City, and Bobby was in the vanguard of change.
Yeah, well, you know, once I got to New York, there was so much music going on. I mean, the energy level was unbelievable, you know, because on the way to a rehearsal, you could stop at 125th Street in Lenox and listen to Malcolm X for an hour, you know. I mean, that was enough to make you want to practice for 2 months straight, you know, right? There's just that energy that he was giving you, you know.
But in the 60s, things could come crashing down suddenly. That's what happened to Bobby in 1967 when he and Joe Chambers were busted for marijuana and thrown into the Manhattan House of Detention, better known as the Tombs. A federal judge called this awful city jail a fortress of bedlam. Getting locked up in the Tombs was not only a harrowing experience. With the arrest, Bobby's cabaret card was taken away, meaning he could not perform in New York City jazz clubs. And he lost his hack license, which had allowed him to get through lean times by driving a taxi. His ability to work in New York was ruined, but through his many recordings, both as a leader and sideman, Bobby's musical reputation was soaring. He returned home to Los Angeles, and he soon had a hit record with a funky tune called With his many recordings, Bobby had established his reputation around the world as a leader of his jazz generation on Vibes, a mantle he shared only with his East Coast counterpart, Gary Burton.
Bobby and I came from the same generation of players, players that, you know, came of age in the 1960s. And so, to me, Bobby has been, you know, the other guy on the Vibes during from my generation. I've always respected his playing and, you know, considered him, you know, one of the giants of the Vibes.
Bobby's association with Northern California began in 1970 at a San Francisco jazz club called the Both And. He became a regular there not only because an old friend was the owner, but because he had a special fondness for the young lady who took the tickets, Rosemary Zuniga. A year later, the royalties from helped Bobby buy a house in Montara, and in 1972, Bobby and Rosemary were married and settled in and raised a family. And Bobby's artistry kept growing.
I guess as I got older, I started learning how to finish off my phrases. I guess one of the most important things I think I'd learned was how to play a ballad. You know, it's like making a movie. It's easy to do a scene where everybody's going crazy and screaming, but it's hard to do a shot where two people are just sitting across the table from each other in a restaurant having idle dinner conversation. That's a much harder situation. And so I've learned a little more about how to sit across the table and have idle dinner conversation.
In the 70s, Bobby added to his performances the marimba, an instrument that had been ignored in jazz. A teenage vibist in Rochester, New York, was one of the many younger players heavily impressed and influenced by Hutcherson. Like many vibes players, he eventually added marimba to his performances. In 2011, Bobby and Gary Burton tied for first place on vibraphone in the prestigious Downbeat Critics poll. The New Star Award went to Joe Locke.
He just plays beautiful, beautiful, beautiful marimba, and the instruments are so different. One is made of metal, and one is made of wood. But to me, it's still Bobby, whether it's marimba or whether it's vibes. And you hear this beautiful, glassy kind of sound that was very particular to him, and these cascades and these runs that just sound like. They just sound like water going from above to below, you know?
there's a track called Even Later. And Even Later is this beautiful sort of, wow, I don't know even what to call it, man, benediction. It's a meditation. And that's really one I would recommend listening to for his marimba playing, one of many.
The 70s were strong years for Bobby, due in no small measure to his frequent gigs at the San Francisco Jazz Club, Keystone Corner. Performing often there with his own groups and his guest artists with touring combos, Bobby's playing kept evolving, as did his composing. Keystone's owner, Todd Barkin, also worked with Bobby as a producer and tour manager.
When I was on tour with Bobby Hutcherson in Europe, and we went out one afternoon before an engagement, and we walked along a river in Austria. You know, the sun was going down, and we were getting ready to go to the concert. That evening, he wrote a song called The Stroll, and it perfectly captured what that afternoon stroll was like. And the song he wrote, which goes da 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 da, the way he captures that note after note and the way he puts those notes together perfectly crystallized the moment, both the emotion of the moment and even the visual elements of the moment. Deep humanity comes through in every note that he plays, stylistically.
Bobby has never stopped growing as an artist, continually formulating many of his own concepts and musical ideas. Joe Gilman is a professor of music at American River College in Sacramento. He's also been Bobby's pianist since 2006.
He deals not so much with chord progressions and scales and all that business, but he's mostly concerned with the sound. He'll say, okay, here's this tune. Now when we get to this part here, here's the sound. And he'll play an exact shape on the vibes. It has an emotional context to it, rather than the traditional 100 years of theme and variation that we've been dealing with in this music for all this time.
The many dimensions of Bobby Hutcherson's artistry come together on an album called Solo Quartet. On several of the tracks, he overdubs all of the instruments and plays his own personal compositions, like one called For You, Mom and Dad. Bobby says what his music is really all about is people.
I don't think it's me writing. It's almost they're doing the writing. The song is their image. I'm just the reflection. Everybody has their own view of a person's personality or a person, what they meant to them. But the main thing is that that energy, that person, that spirit, I mean, long after they've died, is going to always be remembered and will always be there, just like a ripple, a wave, you know, a splash of water. That ripple goes on forever.
For Cross Currents, I'm David Ross.
To hear that and all of our stories, go to KALW.org. And as part of our ongoing series, My Mixtape, we asked Bobby Hutcherson to tell us about his favorite song. Here's what he said.
My name is Bobby Hutcherson. I live in Montero, California. And my song is Happy Birthday. Probably one of the first songs I ever heard in my life. Everybody sang it, was always happy to sing it. So that's got to be very influential to me, something that brings great memories. And surprisingly, as it's written, it's almost in the form of a blues. A song that brings great joy. And we'll always do it. Every time it's played, you can be in a restaurant having a birthday party, and when you start singing Happy Birthday, everybody in the whole restaurant starts singing. Everybody knows the words. Song brings a lot of happiness. And it's always wonderful living another year. Yeah, happy birthday.
You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, RTM's Konohovs, Nina Morente, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Casey Miner. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.